Virgin. This is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Ira Melman. Coming up, organized opposition to Thailand's coup has materialized. Thailand's seafood industry is battling reports of links to human trafficking. And we discuss a report detailing how Myanmar authorities are threatening students there for expressing their political opinions. These stories and more on this Wednesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. The first organized opposition to Thailand's military coup has emerged, with an exiled leader vowing to work with fellow dissidents to restore democratic principles. The formation of the Organization of Free Thais for Human Rights and Democracy was announced Tuesday in an open letter by Jerepong Ruangsuan. Jerepong was the head of the Putai Party of Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat, who was ousted by a constitutional court ruling just before the military takeover in May. He said the new campaign will oppose the military dictatorship, which he slammed as anti-democratic and aimed at entrenching the army's role in politics. It's not clear where the group will be based or how will oppose the junta, which has cracked down harshly on any sign of protest against its takeover. Recent reports have suggested that a movement was being formed in an unspecified country outside Thailand to help organize resistance against the military. The group is made up of a coalition of ex-lawmakers, academics, and other leaders belonging to the so-called Red Shirt movement. The Red Shirts are generally supporters of Ms. Yingluck's brother, ex-Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, who was ousted in a 2006 military coup. Mr. Thaksin, who is living in self-imposed exile, is not believed to have joined the anti-coup movement announced on Tuesday. Thailand reels in more than $7 billion a year as the world's third largest exporter of seafood. But the industry has been tainted by links to human trafficking. Leaders of Thailand's shrimp and tuna suppliers say they're being unfairly maligned, causing damage to their businesses, which employ hundreds of thousands of people. VOA correspondent Steve Herman has more from Bangkok.
Thailand's fishing industry relies on migrant labor. Rights groups and Western media have uncovered evidence of a brutal system of slavery utilizing trafficked workers. Min Min Chan from Myanmar claims that 8 years ago, at the age of 17, he was tricked by a recruiter and sold to a Thai fishing boat for little more than $600. He says for several years he toiled on the ship with little sleep, water, or food. And when he became seriously ill, the captain told him not to stop working.
I thought it was better to die by jumping into the water than to die by being tortured by these people. When I was about to jump, my friend grabbed me from behind and saved my life.
He later escaped and hid out on Indonesia's Ambon Island until this year, when he was repatriated by the International Organization for Migration. Such testimony has led to Thailand being listed among the worst violators of trafficking in persons. The U.S. State Department, in its annual report on the issue, cites surveys contending between 17% and 57% of those in Thailand's seafood industry work against their will. Those statistics are rejected by industry officials here, who question the sources and reliability of the data. The Thai Tuna Industry Association, formed last year, says it allows external verification to ensure workers are treated ethically. At a news conference, a coalition of Thailand's frozen shrimp industry stated there is no slavery involved in the shrimp supply chain. An industry leader, Panisuan Jamnarwet, asserts Thailand's prawns have been clean of exploitative labor for years. The former president of the Thai Frozen Foods Association says the industry cannot risk concealing damaging information.
Consumer perception, we have to work on it. We have to provide the truth. If we keep lying, sooner or later they'll discover, and now it'll be even worse than what's happening at the moment.
So you're confident that the information you're getting
Yes.
is truthful?
Yes.
The publicity is having an impact. Some major international retailers are dropping suppliers linked to the allegations of slavery. The overseas buyers are planning to work with non-governmental organizations to try to ensure that there is no forced labor in the supply chain. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
The United Nations estimates that countries in Asia account for about 80% of the world's disaster events, such as typhoons, earthquakes, and heat waves. As nations try to better plan for responding to and recovering from disasters, the UN has convened a gathering of about 40 countries in Bangkok to discuss how to ensure that human and economic losses are kept to a minimum. Ron Corbin has the story from Bangkok.
Over 2,500 delegates from more than 40 countries are attending the four-day conference on disaster risk reduction as governments and authorities look to further build on gains from the past decade in efforts to reduce the loss of life from catastrophic events. Opening the conference, Thailand's deputy of the ruling military junta, General Thanasak Pattimprakorn, says economic losses from disasters in the Asia-Pacific are getting larger, with the region now an increasing driver of global economic growth.
Asia-Pacific is a high-risk region that suffered in the past 10 years from most natural disaster. More than 10 major disasters took place in this region, causing invaluable damages to lives and properties. For Thailand, we suffered two major disasters, including the tsunami in 2004 and the Great Flood.
Thailand's 2011 flood claimed over 800 people's lives, with economic costs in excess of $45 billion, hitting major industrial zones in central provinces that affected global manufacturing chains in auto and electronics industries. The current regional conference is part of a series of international agreements that followed the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami that claimed over 230,000 lives across 14 countries. In 2008, the devastating cyclone Nargis in Myanmar, also known as Burma, claimed more than 100,000 lives. In November last year, communities in the Philippines were hit by Typhoon Haiyan, claiming 6,000 lives. But other nations, such as India and Bangladesh, also prone to typhoons and cyclones, have made major gains in mitigating death tolls by way of early warning systems and improved local preparedness. Margarita Wallström, UN's representative of the Secretary General for Disaster Risk Reduction, says progress has come in building local community resilience and effective awareness campaigns.
We can say that fewer people lose their lives. We can say that in some countries economic losses are beginning to get under control. We do know that we have much better early warning systems, but we also know they need to become even better. We know that many countries have much better preparedness for disaster response, and we know that many countries effectively evacuate people to save lives in times of crisis.
Wallström cites mass evacuations in the Philippines ahead of Typhoon Haiyan last November and in India ahead of Cyclone Palin last October as examples of the kind of steps that can save many lives. Wallström also says better grassroots development, such as improved health systems, education, and higher incomes, have acted as foundation blocks enabling communities to withstand disasters. This week's meeting is aimed at developing a new set of recommendations on legislative reforms, decentralising authority, creating more effective warning systems, and empowering women who are often the most vulnerable in disaster areas. The final recommendations from the Asia-Pacific Ministerial will then be under consideration at the third UN World Conference on Disaster Risk Reduction in Sendai, Japan, in March 2015. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Chinese authorities Tuesday reported an attack on security personnel at a checkpoint in the rest of far western region of Xinjiang, confirming a days-old report by Radio Free Asia that said that five people had been killed. The official confirmation came in an article by the local government about public safety sessions against terrorism, apparently set up in response to the Friday attack, although the article provided few details on the attack. In a Sunday report, Radio Free Asia said assailants stabbed two police officers guarding a security checkpoint in a village in Qaraqash County and set fire to a room in which three other officers were sleeping, killing all five. The village chief, Atwulu Kasim, told RFA that the attackers locked the door from the outside and poured gasoline into the room through a chimney before setting fire to it. The local government article said militia members manning a checkpoint were killed. A man who answered the call at the local police station said he had no knowledge of the case. Confirmation of such attacks can be difficult because authorities can often play down attacks targeting symbols of power. Xinjiang, the home to the Muslim minority of Uyghurs, has seen rising violence in recent years. Beijing blames it on Uyghur militants seeking independence, but Uyghurs have complained of repressive culture and religious policies and practices by the ruling majority Han Chinese, as well as economic disenfranchisement on their resource-rich homeland. This is Daybreak Asia from the Voice of America. Our weekly report on international education takes us to Myanmar, the country also referred to as Burma. The Myanmar government has warned university students there that they could be expelled if they become involved in politics. It is worded like this: if students under the Ministry of Science and Technology are involved in political activities, they'll be subject to expulsion from the university, said the statement, which was issued on June 9th by the ministry, which is responsible for public science and technology institutions. About 40 institutions come under this group, including five universities, 13 technical higher education institutions, and 17 technical colleges. We welcome to Daybreak Asia Rachel Wagley, the policy director of the U.S. Campaign for Burma here in Washington. Rachel, thanks for being with us. What's been the reaction so far to this edict throughout Myanmar, Burma?
Yeah, thanks. It's been very disappointing. I think students and civil society organizations and activists are very concerned about this suppression of free speech. The government is essentially saying that they cannot participate in political activities whatsoever, and it's a direct violation of their basic rights.
What has been the reaction to this by student bodies and students throughout Myanmar?
I think people are very confused. The government continually says they're moving toward a more democratic system, but then they have these policies that are oppressing people's rights to assembly, people's rights to speech, people's rights to partake in the political system that ostensibly exists. And this is a very clear violation of human rights, and it suppresses students' ability to have free dialogue on campus, which is the very point of a university, is to encourage debate and dialogue.
But historically, universities have been the nurseries for opposition, especially political opposition. Do you think this is why this is happening?
Yeah, it is the universities that have created the impetus for students to organize over pushing for democracy and political reforms. So the government is very wary that the universities will once again become the nursery for breeding more protests for political openings and democratic reform. But I think this restriction by the government just proves how necessary it is for students to be able to gather and to have political rights so that they do have basic human rights.
What do you know, if you do know anything, about a reason why the government has come through with this crackdown all of a sudden on its universities?
Yeah, certainly it's not surprising. And we're seeing all over the country over the past year and a half, 2 years, that even as political prisoners are being released, there's a whole new crowd of people being arrested or rearrested for protesting government policy, for protesting land confiscations, for protesting big extractive deals, and for protesting issues to do with basic rights. So this is just another one of these, and I think the reason why the government sees this as so potentially harmful a location for them is that we have in the past, of course, in 2007 and the late 80s and early 90s, seen student uprisings that were huge social movements. And so this is a strategy for the government to suppress these movements from occurring again. And we're seeing the universities telling students at the beginning of their terms that they are not allowed to take part in political activities whatsoever.
Is there anything that can be done from outside the country?
Certainly. I think this is where the U.S. government should be stepping up and saying, hey, it's the role of the university is to support dialogue and to create a safe space where students can learn how to be active members of democracy and become citizens of a state rather than become minions of a state. And that's what we're seeing. So it'd be really powerful if we saw the U.S. Embassy and other embassies in Rangoon speak out against this and talk to their government counterparts about how the role of a university and how that Burma should be approaching democracy through the lens of student groups and student unions.
Rachel Wegley is Policy Director of the U.S. Campaign for Burma in Washington, D.C. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Authorities in Pakistan are looking for a gunman who opened fire at a commercial airliner Tuesday evening, just as it was landing in the volatile northwest. One person was killed, two others wounded in the attack. A spokesman for Pakistan International Airways says a female passenger on board the plane died on the way to the hospital. He said 178 passengers and an undetermined number of crew were on board on the flight that had come from Saudi Arabia. This week, a prominent cleric-turned-politician returned to Pakistan, vowing to organize anti-government protest. Canada-based Tehrul Qadri has pledged a peaceful revolution against a corrupt democracy. That's a quote. But the sudden homecoming has fueled speculation that Pakistan's powerful military may be using him as a proxy in efforts to sideline the political government. Ayaz Ghul has more from Islamabad.
Widely known as a pro-army cleric, Tahirul Qadri's Pakistan Awami Tehreek is one of the country's most organized political parties. Its base of support is rooted in Qadri's large following from the vast network of mosques and religious centers he set up across Pakistan. Last year, he led mass rallies against Pakistan's previous government. Now he has returned to lead what his spokesman has called an Arab Spring-style revolt and bring a new government to power that can improve accountability and push through reforms. Qadri's ability to quickly organize mass rallies and openly denounce the civilian government has long been seen as evidence that he is backed by the army as a way of sidelining civilian leaders. Daniel Aziz is a lawmaker in the ruling party.
Do you think that Tahrul Qadri would be able to make the kinds of statements that he's making and do the kinds of activities that he's doing in Canada where he's a dual national? Do you think they'd put up with this?
On Monday, Qadri was scheduled to arrive in Islamabad on an Emirates flight from Dubai, but authorities diverted the plane with nearly 300 passengers to Lahore, citing security concerns. The move outraged thousands of his supporters waiting outside the airport in the capital, leading to violent clashes with police. It also triggered protests elsewhere in the country. After several hours on the tarmac, Qadri eventually agreed to deplane but vowed to lead nationwide anti-government rallies to avenge the deaths of around a dozen supporters killed a week ago when Lahore police opened fire on a crowd outside Qadri's residence. That crackdown prompted severe criticism of the Nawaz Sharif government, and Monday's plane incident has even intensified it. Raza Rumi, a television anchor and editor, says the overreaction by the government stems from the troubled democratic history of Pakistan, where the military has seized power through repeated coups.
Pakistan's history has been that when there is a confrontation like this, the civil-military relationship is going down, then the military sort of reacts or comes back with a kind of political engineering that attacks the incumbent government, weakens it, and creates an environment in public opinion where the population, the electorate, is ready for a political change.
Widely dubbed as self-styled revolutionary, last year Qadri briefly returned to Pakistan to lead a similar protest against the previous government. Thousands of his supporters staged a three-day sit-in demonstration in the heart of Islamabad that dispersed peacefully. However, this time he has vowed not to leave Pakistan until he accomplishes his mission. God willing, he says, it will be a movement of revolution, and this peaceful war will be fought until miseries of the poor are ended, oppressions against the innocent are avenged, and corruption is eliminated. There is growing public concern over the country's ongoing battle against Taliban militants, but ruling party lawmaker Daniel Aziz links Qadri's sudden return to Pakistan to the ongoing treason trial of former military president Pervez Musharraf.
The first time in Pakistan, two things are happening at the same time, that democracy has shifted through a peaceful election from one party to another. And now, after many years of these kinds of episodes taking place, there's also a treason trial underway. The establishment has not minced its words on its feelings regarding the trial that's ongoing.
Opposition lawmaker Asad Umar disagrees, saying ruling party members are raising concerns over military interference in politics to distract the public from the failings of their own long-promised political and economic reforms. Discontent with the Sharif government has grown in recent months because of nationwide power shortages that have crippled economic activities in Pakistan. Moreover, critics say that a lack of clarity on how to tackle a deadly Islamist insurgency at home and reported differences with the military in terms of dealing with neighboring Afghanistan and India are primary sources of civil military tensions. Observers are unsure whether Qadri's homecoming is meant to fuel these tensions and whether other opposition political parties would want to join a man accused of promoting undemocratic forces to take charge of the national affairs. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Hundreds of thousands of people are fleeing Pakistan's war-torn North Waziristan region are being vaccinated against polio. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
The Pakistani government reports more than 435,000 people have fled their homes since it began its military operation against Al-Qaeda-linked Taliban forces in North Waziristan 10 days ago. Most are leaving for other parts of Pakistan to live in host communities with family and friends. The World Health Organization is taking advantage of the flight to immunize hundreds of thousands of children and adults against polio. The Taliban banned polio vaccinations in North Waziristan from June 2012. As a consequence, the World Health Organization reports this paralytic disease has made a comeback in the region. WHO polio spokeswoman Shona Bari says there was a huge outbreak of polio in Pakistan during the past year, most of it based in North Waziristan.
So this outflux of the population from North Waziristan is our first opportunity to vaccinate these people in 2 years. Over 70 children have been paralyzed by polio in the past year in Pakistan. So there are now vaccinations going on. Everybody leaving the agency is being vaccinated, so that's upwards of 390,000 people.
She says everyone is being asked if they want the polio vaccination. She says no one has refused or resisted. She says it is a positive development that so many people are receiving vaccine protection. But she tells VOA there also is a downside, as such a large number of people leaving North Waziristan poses a big threat to the rest of the population.
Pakistan has had 82 cases of polio this year, compared to all of last year, they had 93. So a huge boom in polio cases in Pakistan, mostly in North Waziristan. So there is a risk that now with the population moving out, the virus will move out. However, the rest of Pakistan is fairly well vaccinated. So I do think that the government is on top of the situation. It's not often one can say that about governments, but they are on top of the polio situation, and I do think it will be contained, yes.
The UN Refugee Agency says up to 500,000 people could be displaced by the military operation in North Waziristan. UNHCR says the government has formally asked for assistance in dealing with the humanitarian crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Daybreak Asia. My name is Ira Melman. Make sure you stay tuned for the latest world news on International Edition with Steve Norman, up next on many of these same frequencies. Enjoy your day.